Thank you so much, everybody, for coming and for greeting me with love. it's hard for me to really pick a part from this book to read because it ranges over landscapes which are all interconnected in strange ways. But I'm just going to go ahead and read from the middle of the book, and then maybe in the conversation things will become a little clearer. So the chapter that I'm going to read is called The Tenant, and it's about a woman called Tilotama who has just stolen a baby from a in Delhi. There's this place called Jantar Mantar where very many protest movements converge, and some there are people who have been on hunger strike for years, and there are nuts and ideologues and real resistance movements and artists. And so this baby suddenly appears right next to the group of Kashmiri mothers for the disappeared who don't know what to do with the baby that's appeared. And then so Tilotama, nobody knows what to do with the baby, and finally they call the police, and when the police come, the baby has disappeared because Tilotama has just taken it and run. So this is the chapter called The Tenant. It starts with a quote of Jean Genet, which says, "Then, as she had already died four or five times, the apartment had remained available for a drama more serious than her own death. The spotted owlet on the streetlight ducked and bobbed with the delicacy and immaculate manners of a Japanese businessman. He had an unobstructed view through the window of the small bare room and the odd bare woman on the bed. She had an unobstructed view of him too. Some nights she bobbed back and said, 'Moshi, moshi,' which was all the Japanese she knew. Even indoors, the walls radiated a bullying, unyielding heat. The slow ceiling fan stirred the scorched air, layering it with fine, cindery dust. The room showed signs of celebration. The balloons tied to the window grill bumped into each other desultorily, softened and shriveled by the heat. In the center, on a low painted stool, was a cake with bright strawberry icing and sugar flowers, a candle with a charred wick, a matchbox, and a few used matchsticks. On the cake it said, 'Happy birthday, Miss Jubin.' The cake had been cut, a small piece eaten. The icing had melted and dribbled onto the silver foil covered cardboard cake base. Ants were making off with crumbs larger than themselves. Black ants, pink crumbs. The baby, whose birthday and baptism ceremonies had been simultaneously celebrated and successfully concluded, was fast asleep. Her kidnapper, who went by the name of S. Tilotama, was awake and concentrating. She could hear her hair growing. It sounded like something crumbling, a burnt thing crumbling, coal, toast, moths crisped on a light bulb. She remembered reading somewhere that even after people died, their hair and nails kept growing, like starlight traveling through the universe long after the stars themselves had died, like cities, fizzy, effervescent, simulating the illusion of life while the planet they had plundered died around them. She thought of the city at night, of cities at night, discarded constellations of old stars fallen from the sky, rearranged on earth in patterns and pathways and towers, invaded by weevils that have learned to walk upright. A weevil philosopher with a grave manner and a sharp mustache was teaching a class, reading aloud from a book. Admiring young weevils strained to catch each word that spilled from his wise weevil lips. Nietzsche believed that if pity were to become the core of ethics, misery would become contagious and happiness an object of suspicion. The youngsters scratched away on their little notepads. Schopenhauer, on the other hand, believed that pity is and ought to be the supreme weevil virtue. But long before them, Socrates asked the key question, why should we be moral? He had lost a leg in Weevil World War IV, this professor, and carried a cane. His remaining five legs were in excellent condition. Airbrush graffiti sprayed on the back wall of his classroom said, evil weevils always make the cut. Other creatures crowded into the already crowded classroom. An alligator with a human skin purse, a grasshopper with good intentions, a fish on a fast, a fox with a flag, a maggot with a manifesto, a neocon newt, an icon iguana, a communist cow, an owl with an alternative, a lizard on TV. Hello and welcome. You're watching Lizard News at 9. There's been a blizzard on Lizard Island. The baby was the beginning of something. This much the kidnapper knew. Her bones had whispered this to her that night, the said night, the concerned night, the aforementioned night, the night hereinafter referred to as the night, when she made her move on the pavement. And her bones were nothing if not reliable informants. The baby was Miss Jabeen returned. Returned, that is, not to her. Miss Jabeen the first was never hers, but to the world. Miss Jabeen the second, when she was grown to be a lady, would settle accounts and square the books. Miss Jabeen would turn the tide. There was hope yet for the evil, weevil world. Naga asked Thilo for one good reason why she was leaving him. Did he not love her? Had he not been caring, considerate, generous, understanding? Why now, after all these years? He said 14 years was enough time for anyone to get over anything, provided they wanted to get over it. People had been through much worse. Oh, that, she said. I got over all that long ago. I'm happy and well adjusted now, like the people of Kashmir. I've learned to love my country. I may even vote in the next election. He let that pass. He said she should think about seeing a psychiatrist. Thinking made her throat ache. That was a good reason not to think about seeing a psychiatrist. Naga had started wearing tweed coats and smoking cigars like his father did, and talking to servants in the imperious way that his mother did. Termites on toast, khadi loincloths, and the Rolling Stones were a forgotten fever dream from a past life. Naga's mother, who lived alone on the ground floor of the big house, his father, Ambassador Shiv Shankar Hariharan, had died, advised him to let Thilo go. She won't be able to manage on her own. She'll beg you to take her back. Naga knew otherwise. Thilo would manage, and even if she didn't, there would be no begging. He sensed she was drifting on a tide that neither he nor she could do much about. He couldn't tell whether her restlessness, her compulsive and increasingly unsafe wandering through the city, marked the onset of an unsoundness of mind or an acute, perilous kind of sanity. Or were they both the same thing? The only thing he could attribute her newfound restiveness to was her mother's bizarre passing, which he thought odd, given that it was a relationship that had barely existed. True, Thilo had been at her bedside during the last 2 weeks in hospital, but other than that, she had seen her mother only a few times in the past several years. Naga was right in one sense, but wrong in another. Her mother's death had released Thilo from an internment that nobody, including she herself, had been aware of, because it had passed itself off as something quite the opposite, a peculiar, insular independence. For all of her adult life, Thilo had defined and shaped herself by marking off and maintaining a distance between herself and her mother. When that was no longer necessary, something frozen began to thaw, and something unfamiliar began to take its place. Naga's pursuit of Thilo had not turned out as planned. She was meant to be just another easy conquest, yet another woman who had succumbed to his irreverent brilliance and edgy charm and had her heart broken. But Thilo had crept up on him and become a kind of compulsion, an addiction almost. Addiction has its own mnemonics, skin, smell, the length of the loved one's fingers. In Thilo's case, it was the slant of her eyes, the shape of her mouth, the almost invisible scar that slightly altered the symmetry of her lips and made her look defiant even when she did not mean to, the way her nostrils flared and announcing her displeasure even before her eyes did, the way she held her shoulders, the way she sat on the pot stark naked and smoked cigarettes. So many years of marriage, the fact that she was not young anymore and did nothing to pretend otherwise didn't change the way he felt, because it had to do with more than all that. It was the haughtiness, despite the question mark over her stock, as his mother had not hesitated to put it. It had to do with the way she lived in the country of her own skin, a country that issued no visas and seemed to have no consulates. True, it had never been a particularly friendly country, even at the best of times. But its borders were sealed and the regime of more or less complete isolationism began only after the train wreck at the Shiraz cinema. Naga married Thilo because he was never really able to reach her. And because he couldn't reach her, he couldn't let her go. Of course, that raises another question. Why did Thilo marry Naga? A generous person would say it was because she needed shelter. A less generous view would be that it was because she needed cover. Although his was only a small part in the story, in Naga's mind, before and after Shiraz sometimes took on the overtones of BC and AD. Thank you.
I don't think anyone would mind if you kept reading. That was lovely. I didn't say much about the book in its particulars, that it's set in Delhi and it's set in Kashmir primarily, and that there's a story of a hijra named Anjum that's one whole part of this story, and then there's, as you read from part of this story, of Thilo and these three men that she knows over a period of time. How did these come to you, and then how did they come together as a book?
Well, you know, they just began to drop in on me, and then they just started to hang around a lot, and then they just moved in, and they wouldn't go away, and people often ask me, you know, why did it take you so long to write another novel? And to me, the thing is that I just knew that I had to wait. To me, a novel is never business. It's never a duty. It's a prayer. It's a song. And all you can do is wait for it to come to you, you know? I also felt that... you know, I mean, I actually don't know how to explain it, but maybe on the one hand, suddenly becoming very famous because you wrote a book, there's this pressure. It's a sort of there's a domestication that happens where, you know, generally you're expected to write the God of Small Things 2 and then the Son of the God of Small Things. And also I think fiction itself, you know, maybe because the speed at which things are sold and how you have to sell books to people who haven't read them or whatever it is, you know, suddenly it's become like a Hollywood thing. You have to explain in 6 verbs what the book is about or something. And you have to sign contracts and you have to have publishers breathing down your neck. And I just... didn't want that, you know. I wanted to see how fiction as a form could be pushed to do things that only fiction can do. So how can I write a book that is not masquerading as a film script or as a history book, as a newspaper, or as an ideology with animated characters that are playing out some prefabricated theme of mine? And yet, how can you capture the terror, the beauty, the poetry, the complexity, the fact that in the modern world, even in India now, we don't have a second which is a second, because in that second you are getting text messages and emails and internet and someone sitting, you know, so all those shattered seconds. And so how do you, it was an experiment with the form of the book, it's with the form of fiction itself for me.
Well, it, reading it, I mean, I think, I'm sure many of people here, everyone was so excited to get this book and you want to race into the book, and yet, and this was mirrored by what people in New York said about reading, they have to read these things quickly, but it was, then you realize this book doesn't want you, it doesn't feel like it wants you and to read that way, it wants you to slow down. Those characters really, there is a sense that they've lived, those who have a length to their lives have it, and there's something that comes out in the writing that way that you convey that this character wasn't just quickly conceived and was lived with a while. Do you pick up a book and you read it different speeds, different ways? Do you think?
No, I don't want to speed through anything ever, you know. So not even a meal or no. And the only thing I'm speeding through seems to be the book tour, which is terrible. But that's also because I want to get back home. But the thing is that I think all over the world, I mean, surely in America and in India, not in similar ways, in unique and separate ways, there is something psychotic unfolding in the air, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not that we haven't, as a species, lived through the First World War and the Second World War. So I'm not talking about just the numbers of the dead or wars, but there's something going on which is, I think, endangering us as a species, not just because of climate change, but because of this amount of information that we are supposed to process all the time. And so, I when I wrote the book and when I was writing the book, I never theorized about it. I never had a theory that I wanted to then sort of put into practice. But afterwards, I was looking, when I started to have to talk about it and think about it in abstract ways, the fact that India as a society, although from the outside looks like a anarchic, chaotic, sort of friendly, you know, stuffed toy democracy, the fact is that it's not anarchic. The fact is that it is a society that lives in a very fine grid, not just a grid, a mesh, an iron mesh of caste. Like there's 4,000 different castes, and every caste is bound by the iron grid. And there are less than 5% of transgressions or marriages outside religion, outside caste, and people have to function in this way. And the violence, the fires that burn along these fault lines is something that we have to live with and have had to live with. Now it's become a situation of absolute horror. Every day people are being lynched, people are being killed because the government in power believes that it should be declared a Hindu nation and so on. But the characters in the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, all of them, I realize now, have a sort of incendiary boundary running through them, a border running through them. So whether it's the border of gender, whether it's the border of religious conversion, I mean, one of the characters is called, he calls himself Saddam Hussein, because he is a Dalit who watched his father being lynched by a mob who call themselves cow protectors. This is happening every day now in India almost. And he converts to Islam. And has on his phone a video of the execution of Saddam Hussein, and is very impressed by the disdain Saddam shows for the executioners. So he calls himself Saddam Hussein. There are, Tilotama has the border of caste running through her. The characters in Kashmir have, of course, national borders running through them. So through these people who are not necessarily all sort of belonging to the poorer sections of society, Tilo and others are even middle-class people, there's a spectrum. And yet, because of those borders, they look at this grid and begin to ask some very, very profound questions.
In my long talking beforehand, I neglected to mention you've actually done quite you've written a book-length essay on caste, the writing of B.R. Ambedkar, and actually taking issue with M.K. Gandhi on that whole issue. But that in itself is a book that's downstairs and worth reading. Near the end of the book, two of the central characters in this book, and they've lived through all of these things, and they're maybe the two most drawn to each other of any two in the book, except maybe somewhat around some of the baby Jabil. But these two people, adults, there's a conversation where one decries we're going to make up a word here, the stupidification of things. And then you've written a little about that in some essays too, which is something where these whole societies are having kind of some of the same force. Could you say a little more about how this works in this book? Because the book is such an eloquent argument against that.
Yeah. Well, that's a conversation between Tilotama and a character called Musa, who was her lover when they were in college, but he's a Kashmiri, and then they drifted apart and then meet again in Kashmir. He's a militant. He's underground and he's part of the resistance movement against the occupation. So Kashmir is the most densely militarized zone in the world. And Musa is trying to explain to her how. So, it's hard to talk about it, but so basically one of the reasons that if you were to visit Kashmir, for example, you realize very quickly that you can't tell this story just with reportage, just with human rights reports, just with a sort of summing up of the dead or the tortured or the wounded. Because what does it mean? What does it mean to live under the boot of the military for 25 years? What does it do to the military? What does it do to the people? What does it do to the negotiators? What does it do to the, you know, all of them? And Musa is talking to Tilo, and he says, the thing is that the more than freedom, we are just now fighting for dignity, for our dignity. We cannot live without dignity. And so when we fight one of the world's biggest armies as a people, we have to become as mechanical and as monolithic as the army that we face. We have to do away with our diversity. We have to become stupid, you know? So that's the explanation of how, and he says we cannot win this battle with our bodies. We have to recruit our souls. And so it's really about how this polarization happens. And she's in a way very much very, very different from him. She's not, she's a lone person, you know, who is alienated by the society that has kind of made her outside of it. And he, although he's fighting a resistance movement, and because he's fighting, actually owns his people and belongs to them. So, I could read it to you. So she, She says, it says they had always fitted together like pieces of an unsolved and perhaps unsolvable puzzle. The smoke of her into the solidness of him, the solitariness of her into the gathering of him, the strangeness of her into the straightforwardness of him, the insouciance of her into the restraint of him, the quietness of her into the quietness of him. And then, of course, there were the other parts, the ones that wouldn't fit. What happened that night was less lovemaking than lament. Their wounds were too old and too new, too different and perhaps too deep for healing. But for a fleeting moment, they were able to pool them like accumulated gambling debts and share the pain equally without naming the injuries or asking which was whose. For a fleeting moment, they were able to repudiate the world they lived in and call forth another one just as real.
When, not to take anything away from that setting and its place, Kashmir in India, but I remember when I read that, and we in this country are dealing with some other realities in the last year or more, you know, months and year, but I, a sentence of James Baldwin I just read, where he's writing about the flower children in California in the 1960s, and he, but again, these applies in a larger way, he says, there was nothing harder for them to achieve, nor that was perhaps more in this society. They were born here and there was nothing harder for them to achieve, nor was more feared or scorned than the idea of the soul's maturity. And you have Baldwin elsewhere in this book, so, but that's...
Yeah. Baldwin here says something also very profound. He says that, and they would not believe me precisely because they knew that what I said was true. Yeah. You know, which is why fiction... is truth. Fellini said that fiction is truth because without footnotes and without any kind of factual reportage, when it's true, you know it, and then it becomes dangerous, you know? And that is why it's important for writers to remain dangerous and not to become domesticated.
You said you miss home, and I think you'll get to go there soon. But I know you've been in North and Vancouver in Canada the last few days. So did you know your prime minister's come visit?
I sure did.
Maybe he's been missing you home. He is a character in this book in a certain way.
We can't say that, can we?
I know. We wouldn't. You did say, I remember, literally, I do remember 20 years ago when you were in the basement of Elliott Bay and you were describing The God of Small Things, you said you wanted it to be an unfilmable book. And you have worked in film. I mean, earlier on, you were part of the film world you've known.
What I said was a stubbornly visual but unfilmable book.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the writing is visual. It is visual, but unfilmable was, yeah, there's no question it's visual. So are we there again with this?
I think, like I said, you know, to me the idea is never, I don't want film to be the last stop, you know, this is the last stop. Like, it could, when I'm talking about a film off the book, no, you know, but because it would be something else then. But... I think the idea is so much of what happens in this place is you know, for example, one of the things, apart from how do you when people ask me what it's about, I would say it's about the air we breathe. It's about, you know, people have become frightened of actually writing about the air, and the air is full of lynchings and military occupations and poetry and music and languages and love and all of it, you know, and we should not be frightened of all of it. So one of the things in if you live in the north of India is that all of us on a daily basis just in our lives speak more than one language, always, you know? And how do you translate the cadences of the languages that you hear on the street and that you're interacting with? I mean, Hindi, Urdu, Kashmiri, Malayalam, Telugu, all of it, the poetry and the languages. How do you kind of, without being gimmicky, produce those cadences? And then it's not just other languages, but even voices within the book who translate their own pamphlets, or there are court affidavits, there are letters, incomplete letters, there are recoveries from floods, there are notebooks, you know, so it's, I don't think you can do that in a film.
Yeah. You do so many things in this book. I think this is a good time to move to questions from you. There's a microphone here and one over here on each side, and we'll take turns if people want to ask questions, and again, to try and keep it in the question area.
Quick question. This is a 7-part question. Just joking.
This is what?
Quick question. Is it hard to balance your morals as the more success that you have? And are you ever fearful because you're in the public eye?
Sorry, I didn't get it.
I said, is it hard to balance your morals as you become more successful? And are you ever scared because you're in the public eye?
Oh. It's a double-edged knife. You know, so on the one hand, I have protection because I'm in the public eye, but on the other hand, because I'm in the public eye, it's true for everyone, but open to major attack for the most frivolous reasons sometimes, you know, because it gets people into the news and so on. But for example, my whole 20 years of political writing began after I wrote The God of Small Things in 97. You know, I'd won the Booker Prize and I was on the cover of every magazine, and at that moment the government changed. It became a Hindu nationalist right-wing government, and they did a series of nuclear tests. And I knew that if I did not say anything, it would be assumed that I supported those tests, because I was sort of being portrayed as the new face of the global India and so on. And so I wrote an essay called The End of Imagination, in which I basically came out against the tests and against nationalism and the idea of India as a Hindu nation. And of course I was immediately kicked off my fairy princess pedestal by some people. But it led to an embrace by others, and for 20 years writing the things I wrote. But, you know, just for example, just a week before this book was published, a month before this book was published, in Kashmir, an army officer tied a Kashmiri civilian to a jeep, an armored jeep, and used him as a human shield and drove him around for five or six hours through various villages. It created a great deal of publicity. The army rewarded the officer honored the officer who had done this. It was by no means the worst thing the Indian army has done in Kashmir, by no means, but it just became very public. And then a member of parliament who's also a actor in Bollywood made a statement saying that Arundhati Roy should be used as a human shield in Kashmir. She should be tied to the, you know, army jeep and so on. Of course, it created a lot of, debate. And then TV channels had real debates about whether or not I should be tied to so, you know, it's a bit of a circus, the whole thing sometimes. But I think you have to learn how to live in that society. It took me time. I mean, after I wrote The God of Small Things, I did wonder, you know, whether I would ever regret writing that book for the fame and the position I was put in, and the fact that I didn't want to leave, you know, I didn't want to go and live with other famous people. So then everyone I was living with had to deal with the fame and the whole thing. But everything is, you know, it took a bit of time, but it's okay now.
Actually, in the book, you, in the acknowledgments, you have, I think, seven people who you thank for keeping you out of prison so far.
Yeah. Because I'm actually, every few years, I don't know what is in my karma, but every few years, five male lawyers get together and file a criminal case against me. So the first was... with the God of Small Things, five lawyers in Kerala filed a case against me for obscenity and corrupting public morality. So it was a criminal case, and I had to appear in court. And meanwhile, by the time the date came up, you know, the Booker Prize had happened, and the judge comes up and says, every time this case comes before me, I get chest pains. And then, but it went on for years. The second case was five lawyers said I had tried to kill five men, that I had tried to kill them outside the gates of the Supreme Court. That went on. I actually went to jail for a day for that. And then now, again, I'm under criminal trial for contempt of court because of an essay I wrote about a professor who's 90% disabled, who is in prison, accused of being a terrorist, a Maoist terrorist. And I wrote an article called Professor POW, saying, you know, you've got to give him bail. And for that, five male lawyers appealed to a judge to charge me with contempt of court for trying to influence the process of justice. So that's happening now. So that is the team of lawyers, yes.
You mentioned earlier that this was, in a way, an experiment in the form of fiction. And I was wondering if you could... This book was an experiment, you were experimenting with the form. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that and then talk, maybe give us some examples of how you do that in the book.
Yeah. Well, it was... I wanted to see how you could... I just didn't want to write a book where you have characters whose lives are being played out against a political background or a background of some kind, you know? Sometimes I wanted the background to be the foreground. I wanted the city to become a character. I wanted to be able to break... to be able to walk, so I'm talking about two cities. One is the city itself, which is the geographical city, and the other is the narrative form of a city. And I wanted to be able to never walk past somebody, you know. If there's a guard who's guarding the Honda City poster because now the Honda City hoarding on a public toilet, the guard is guarding the hoarding so that people don't desecrate it. But the guard has a story, right? Where has he come from? Who is he? And so even though I knew that it would test the, you know, the idea the readers are used to, that there has to be these main characters and then you don't just stop by and smoke a cigarette with the guy you're walking past, but I wanted to do that, and I wanted to trust the reader to want to do that too, you know. So how do you write it in a way that it's not baby food, you know? It's not pre-digested, easy to swallow. You got to stop too, and you got to be able to reorient yourself.
I was curious, I've heard a lot of authors say that when they write, they can't think about the readers because it makes them censor what they're writing. And I feel like when I've heard you speak, you have so much that you share through your writing and that you want to share through your writing. So I was curious for you, what role does the reader play in your writing process? How do you think about them? Is it different when you're writing an essay versus a fiction novel?
Oh yeah, it's very different. I mean, the essays are always written. I mean, when they are collected together, people might not get the sense of how urgent they were when they were written, because they're always written at a time and things are closing in, and I needed to open a space because, you know, the army, the paramilitary was being sent into the forest, or court order had come, whatever. So there's the essays are an argument and an urgent intervention. The both my novels have never been that. You know, they are like offerings, they are universes. So I don't think of readers as in readers as a market, but surely there is, it's like writing a letter to someone, you know, more like writing a letter of love to someone, inviting them into a universe, inviting them to walk through that universe. And but there was another aspect when I was writing this book, which is that it's really becoming extremely frightening. I've never been so anxious and so worried, not just on my behalf, but on behalf of so many people in India. I mean, now it's come to a stage where, you know, day before yesterday, a Muslim boy was just pulled off a train and lynched. People are being, you know, they have these WhatsApp groups that deliberately spread false rumors, then they go and beat somebody to death because there's a rumor that they've eaten beef and all of that. So when I was writing this book, surely every time I thought of the consequences or what every sentence can be argued over or come, I could not have written it. So I had to tell myself, just write it however you want to write it and keep it in your drawer. Don't publish it. And I did that. And then the writer's ego came along and said, do publish it, you know. So, but yeah, I did have to not think about that when I was writing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to thank you so much for writing The God of Small Things. It was the first book that when I read it, I felt like I could relate to the characters inside their head, and the twins' grief, as devastating as it was. You know, I found some truth in it, even though I'm so different than them by looking at me and privileged. But I wanted to ask you, because even reading that book, I cried very hard, but yet I also laughed. And I wanted to ask you about your playfulness and your, I think, optimism that runs through your works. Just like you'll have a kidnapped baby and then hearing about these ants marching off with these huge pieces of cake. And it almost is like an act of bravery, maybe. You're also an activist and you see all this tragedy. And how do you find that balance?
You know, I think, again, to me, the idea of telling a story, whether it's a story in fiction or even when I'm writing my essays, you know, there's always a range of things going on and a range of emotions. And to me, it would be like singing a song where there's only one note if there wasn't all that, you know, and if you didn't see all that. I grew up in Kerala, where The God of Small Things is set. I grew up on the banks of a river. I grew up in a village where there was no restaurant, no cinema hall, no shop, no TV, nothing except the river and the fish and the insects and the worms, and, you know, I knew every plant. And now I live in a city and I still see all the insects and I still see all the book is full of animals. This book is full of animals. Much of it is set in the graveyard where the dead and the living have a porous border. Even when I have gone into the forest and lived with the gorillas or walked in, wherever I've been, It's never one emotion, you know. It's, and especially amongst people who are actually fighting with their backs to the wall, there are moments of, in Kashmir, I mean, so much of the time we just spend laughing, you know. It's because we know, eventually we know that whatever it is, even if we don't win, we don't want to be on their side, you know. So we are doing what we believe in and what we are, and therefore will be, you know, someone once asked me, but don't you get depressed when you see the state of the world? I said, well, it's like asking an ant who's trying to cross the highway if they're worried about the traffic. You know, like have a sense of scale. I'm just, you know, not that person that is going to rule the world or change the world. I mean, I'm doing what I can do, and I have to find good things about it. One of my books of essays is actually dedicated to those who have learned to divorce hope from reason.
Hey, how are you? My dad came to this country from India in the 1970s as an Indian Muslim, partly because of he knew he had to work 10 times harder as his Hindu classmates to get the same opportunities. And fast forward to today, and a lot of your themes in the book, I've gotten about halfway through it, seem to touch on this, but do you see an equitable future for Indian Muslims? Because it's, I mean, I don't know if you would even argue if it's worse now than it was then or not, but what do you see in, as far as you mentioned a lot with your characters as well?
Oh God, I wish I didn't have to answer that, because I'm really, you know, I'm so worried about that. You know, I mean, every day, you know, the Prime Minister is visiting Trump here. A few years ago, he was banned from coming here. I mean, not that this country is the, you know, paragon of virtue, but he was not allowed to come because of what he's done.
Either.
Yeah, yes. But what I'm saying is that, you know, in 2002, when he was the chief minister of Gujarat, Muslims were lynched on the street. Women were raped and killed. In fact, when I was speaking in New York, one of the people in the audience was the daughter of a man called Ehsan Jafri, who was a former MLA in Gujarat, whose house at the time of the massacre 60 people or so took shelter, thinking that he's a middle class former politician, nothing's going to happen, and a mob of 10 or 20,000 people gathered. He made hundreds of phone calls, and finally the mob pulled him out and hacked him to death. And all the people were killed, and only his 80-year-old widow is alive, and she's been filing case after case. But you cannot deal with fascism in a court of law, you know. So today, every day, people are being lynched, killed, beaten to death, and it's come to the stage where you're worrying if someone's luggage falls off the luggage rack in the train, and if they're a Muslim, anything can happen. If they're a Dalit, anything can happen. There are vigilantes on the streets. There are mobs on the streets. You know, what's happening is that the great spectacular economic growth, which has not led, surely it's led to some people becoming extremely rich, but it has not led to the bulk of people getting jobs, and all that anger is being directed downwards to the most vulnerable people. So the only hope is that at some point people realize that it's not helping them, all this hatred, you know. And there are, I mean, as we speak today, there are protest rallies all over the world about Modi's visit here. But, you know, I feel that the world does need to pay attention, because it's not, you know, it's not just, there's a huge difference between Modi and Trump. Trump is an outlier who's come in for all the reasons you know, but Modi belongs to an organization called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which was formed in 1925 is and was deeply influenced by Mussolini's black shirts, believes India is a Hindu nation, has hundreds of thousands of volunteers, has publications, schools, rewriting history books. All the big institutions are peopled with their people now. So it's a tide that's rising from the bottom, you know, and the people that are lynching and so on are ordinary people. They're not policemen or anything else. So very, very frightening scenario. Very, very frightening. But as long as the market is open, as long as it's free market friendly democracy, you're not going to hear of this. Tomorrow, if the Indian government nationalizes mineral resources, you'd hear about all this tomorrow, you know?
I haven't read the book yet, but looking at the title, I'm an English teacher. I just taught 1984. So the Ministry of Plenty, the Ministry of Truth, the Ministry of Peace, the Ministry of Love. Did George Orwell have any influence, or what influence does George Orwell have on you?
Well, actually, the Ministry of Utmost Happiness is not a satirical title. It is really about, it's not at all, because eventually to me, the idea that we as a species need to really re-understand or rewrite the recipes of happiness that are being handed down to us, you know? And it's about, I mean, Anjum, who's one of the main characters in the book, she eventually ends up building a guest house in a graveyard, and to which many people come, and it's about finding happiness in extremely unexpected places. It's about the fragility of that and about the wisdom of people who know to recognize it sometimes, you know. Although I'm an admirer of Orwell.
Thank you for being here and being away from home and family, so it's appreciated. There's a sentence in the beginning of your book that's kind of stuck with me throughout the book, and it's about Anjum's mother discovering who he is and not having the right Urdu language to be able to describe him. And it's about, can one live outside of language? Which I thought was a fascinating sentence to have there, because hijras, traditions are passed on only orally, either through song or language. So is that purposely placed there? What did you mean by that sentence? And does it have any connection to your work with displaced and, you know, groups in India?
She talks about it because in Urdu, the language that she speaks, everything, not just every living thing, but everything has a gender except her child. I mean, everything is either masculine or feminine, you know? And so it's like there isn't even a language there, you know, just a word doesn't make a language. Hijra doesn't make a language. So it is about also how language limits the imagination, you know, and how it is another grid that forces people to live within it, you know. And in India, of course, language is so replete with notions of caste and gender and all of that.
Okay, our last question.
Thank you for being here. And I was wondering if you have an opinion on the Gorkhaland agitation that's going on in Darjeeling.
Sorry?
I was wondering if you have an opinion on the Gorkhaland agitation that's going
the
on Gorkhaland in Darjeeling.
The Gorkhaland agitation. Well, I don't want to really talk about that here, you know, because what happens with me is that I say something and then it's all half on Twitter, and then there are 5 lawyers waiting there to start filing a case against me. Okay.
Close, yes.
I will, yeah.
Back to the book.
So I'll just read you 5 minutes. This is from a chapter called The Nativity, and it's about you see what it's about. It was peacetime, or so they said. All morning, a hot wind had whipped through the city streets, driving sheets of grit soda bottle caps and beady stubs before it, smacking them into car windscreens and cyclist eyes. When the wind died, the sun, already high in the sky, burned through the haze, and once again the heat rose and shimmered on the streets like a belly dancer. People waited for the thunder shower that always follows a dust storm, but it never came. Fire raged through a swathe of huts huddled together on the riverbank, gutting more than 2,000 in an instant. Still, the amaltas bloomed, a brilliant, defiant yellow. Each blazing summer, it reached up and whispered to the hot brown sky, "F*** you." She appeared quite suddenly, a little after midnight. No angels sang, no wise men brought gifts, but a million stars rose in the east to herald her arrival. One moment she wasn't there, and the next, there she was on the concrete pavement in a crib of litter, silver cigarette foil, a few plastic bags, and empty packets of Uncle Chips. She lay in a pool of light under a column of swarming neon-lit mosquitoes, naked. Her skin was blue-black, sleek as a baby seal's. She was wide awake but perfectly quiet, unusual for someone so tiny. Perhaps in those first short months of her life, she had already learned that tears, her tears at least, were futile. A thin white horse tethered to the railing, a small dog with mange, a concrete-colored lizard, two palm-striped squirrels who should have been asleep, and from her hidden perch, a she-spider with a swollen egg sac watched over her. Other than that, she seemed to be utterly alone. Around her, the city sprawled for miles, thousand-year-old sorceress, dozing but not asleep, even at this hour. Gray flyovers snaked out of her Medusa skull, tangling and untangling under the yellow sodium haze. Sleeping bodies of homeless people lined their high, narrow pavements, head to toe, head to toe, head to toe, looping into the distance. Old secrets were folded into the furrows of her loose parchment skin. Each wrinkle was a street a carnival, each arthritic joint a crumbling amphitheater where stories of love and madness, stupidity, delight, and unspeakable cruelty had been played out for centuries. But this was to be the dawn of her resurrection. Her new masters wanted to hide her knobby varicose veins under imported fishnet stockings, cram her withered tits into saucy padded bras, and jam her aching feet into pointed high-heeled shoes. They wanted her to swing her stiff old hips and reroute the edges of her grimace upwards into a frozen, empty smile. It was the summer Grandma became a whore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.